Hello, and welcome to a PDI podcast. I'm your host, Mark Oliver Wright, Clinical Science Liaison for the Central Region. With me today is Dr. Catherine Murphy. Dr. Murphy is a registered nurse, currently with the Australian College of Perioperative Nurses as the ACORN Standards Manager. In that role, Kath has been responsible for leading and overseeing the development and promotion of ACORN's professional standards, which currently include, but are not limited to, the Standards for Perioperative Nursing in Australia, ACORN Professional Standards, and the Practice Audit Tools. Kath's career over several decades has covered senior infection prevention positions within the clinical, government, non-government, and professional associations in her home country of Australia, as well as internationally. She is an honorary adjunct associate professor at Bond University on the Gold Coast, Australia. For more than 20 years, Kath has provided independent consulting services for a range of clinical, public policy, professional associations, and commercial clients throughout the world. Career highlights include working in the U.S. as the CDC, consulting for the World Health Organization, and serving as the elected APIC president in 2010. In 2016, Kath became the first non-North American to be awarded APIC's esteemed Carol DeMille Award for lifetime excellence in and dedication to the field of infection prevention. She is currently a credentialed ESIPSI expert, holds the U.S. CIC certification, and is a fellow of APIC. Kath's passion for improving patient safety through better and smarter infection control and prevention is unrelenting. Her ideas are innovative and practical. She looks forward to learning from and giving reliable, high-quality service to her professional peers and colleagues, particularly those involved in the infection control and prevention and perioperative care and nursing. Welcome, Dr. Murphy.
Thank you, Mark. Great to be with you today.
Well, thanks. As of today, Australia has a grand total of about 27,634 cases and 907 deaths due to SARS-CoV-2. There are more cases and more deaths in the city of Philadelphia than in the continent of Australia. Your home province of Queensland's incidence rate is roughly 22.54 per 100,000 people, while my home state of Wisconsin's incidence rate is about 80 times that. Australia's daily case count is in the lower double digits, and the case count seems to show a clear double peak with what appears to be a second wave that started in late June, nearly coming to an end in October. Can you talk a little bit about Australia's response to the SARS-CoV-2 pandemic? Was there a national strategy?
Mark, an interesting and important question, I feel. So we've had, you know, far few cases compared to countries of equivalent size. And I suspect that some of that is obviously because we have a much lower population than others, particularly the US. So our total population, I think, is only around 25 million or 30 million. So we're smaller in numbers. However, COVID has devastated in many ways life in Australia, and certainly there's been a lot of pain for families who've lost loved ones. Our healthcare workers have experienced the stress and the frustrations of this pandemic, as have, I imagine, most healthcare workers around the world. So our government were quite aggressive in the early days of the pandemic, and they implemented what became part of our national strategy. And the first thing that they did, which is not surprising to epidemiologists and infection control professionals, is they decided that containment was very important for Australia as a nation and also for Australians. So they undertook bans immediately on the arrival into Australia of persons from countries that had high incidence of COVID-19 at that point. And so that strategy evolved into increasing controls for persons arriving from all countries. And by mid-March, what we'd done in Australia is we had a system whereby anybody arriving from overseas, either an Australian or a non-citizen, anyone that arrived was automatically subjected to 2 weeks of self-isolation. So that self-isolation meant that people were expected to go to wherever they were staying and to stay there for 2 weeks. And that was not policed, and it was expected that people would do that. In fact, we saw people breaching that decision or that recommendation from our government. And so Australia very quickly strengthened its ability to mandate and set a mandate to quarantine people from overseas. And so from the end of March, anybody coming to Australia must undergo an automatic 2 weeks of quarantine. And that quarantine's happened in many of the major hotels in the larger cities of Australia. The other thing that our country did was Australians cannot, without great exception, cannot leave Australia. So we are probably, for the first time in my life at least, really feeling like we're an isolated continent sitting way out in the lonely part of the world. However, from an infection point of view, I think that's probably a good attribute to have at this point. So the country did some other national strategies. We continued to recommend that persons in mandatory quarantine be subjected to multiple testing for COVID during their quarantine periods. And what we found is that very many of Australia's cases, I think around 20 or 25% of Australia's total COVID cases have actually been imported. So they've come from people coming into the country. And so we saw that quarantining or the locking down of people for the first 2 weeks is very, very important. And that was, I think, an early win for us that limited transmission across the communities. So an important step taken by our Prime Minister and the National Cabinet. What we then started to see as the pandemic evolved were the different states and territories of Australia making their own recommendations around closing their own state or territory borders to other states. And so effectively, our five states and two territories, many of them have been locked down. And even to this day, for example, Queensland, where I live, people from Greater Sydney in New South Wales, which is one of our southern neighbours, they cannot be, they're not allowed to cross the border into Queensland. So there's been an awful lot of border control, and we've used things like the Australian Defence Force to help man those borders. For healthcare workers, some interesting recommendations were made. So along with the rest of the world, our healthcare workers grappled with trying to understand whether this was spread through droplet or through airborne transmission routes. And I think that that confusion, even from, let's say, from May onwards, has continued to confuse healthcare workers. And that always concerns me as an infection preventionist. So our healthcare workers were strongly encouraged to have influenza vaccination as a major method of at least reducing influenza in Australia over the winter. And I know that that's a topic that's of importance to you. And we'll talk about that soon, I hope. So the other things that our healthcare workers did were, you know, they had to wear masks when they were delivering treatment. They had to wear appropriate PPE. And I must say that compared to what I know and am led to believe from my colleagues in infection prevention in North America, I will say that in Australia, we have never had as rigorous requirements and no mandate to do fit testing. So one of the biggest problems I would suspect has been that our healthcare workers and even people that aren't delivering frontline care but still working in hospital environments, very few of them would be at any point in time fully competent in using P2 or N95 masks. So that's a very strong lesson that I think we will take forward, because there's nothing worse than having to play catch up in terms of teaching your staff how to wear PPE appropriately, how to firstly select it, obviously, and then how to remove it and dispose of it safely. So they're important measures. Now, how I got there from you asking me about a national strategy is interesting, but you know, I'm obviously quite proud to tell Australia's story, in my eyes anyway.
I find your description fascinating, particularly with relation to the lockdown measures, both internationally as well as within the individual states. What about the sort of strategies or control measures within the state? So, for example, after you locked down the borders between the five states of Australia, were there mask mandates within Queensland? Were there crowd size restrictions? Anything like that?
Yeah, Mark, a brilliant question again. Thank you. So the states did make their own decisions around many of those issues. And obviously, living in Queensland, I lived through that experience, so I can tell you absolutely what it's been like for us. So from around April, there were limits. We had to stay within our house other than going out for medical appointments or for shopping, which most people would do within the local vicinity. Our schools were closed, as were many other schools in Australia, and families were unable to mix with other family members. So, for example, children, if they didn't live in the same household as their grandchildren, there were restrictions on the number of people that could gather in any house at any particular point. And in the early days, I remember that there were, around Easter time, I think we in Queensland were only allowed to have two other people come into any one household. So, you know, that was very strange, but we saw, I'm not sure why Australia did this, but it's kind of amusing to me that we had this whole rush on toilet paper. So one of the things that we couldn't buy from our stores was toilet paper. And, you know, it was amazing to see someone who'd managed to secure, you know, a 15 or 20 pack of toilet paper. It was like they'd won the golden prize. And even as I went shopping locally, I saw some strange things in terms of mask wearing and glove usage. So, you know, I saw some people using the plastic bags that they would usually bag their fruit and vegetables in a store. They would put those plastic bags on their hand and use them as surrogate gloves as they pushed their shopping trolley around. And, you know, we were all told, well, use a shopping trolley because effectively that will give you a meter between you and the next person. So, you know, there were lifestyle changes which at the time became, you know, they were quite strange. We saw hand hygiene solutions appeared miraculously overnight in stores. We had installation of plexiglass shields between cashiers in stores. We had limitations on the number of people that could go into stores. And yes, we had very strict and policed restrictions on the number of people who could gather outside. And I think, again, that they were only allowed to be four people. And that was quite difficult for Australians, and I'm not sure if it ever made it to the US media reports, but in Sydney, one of our famous beaches is Bondi Beach, and it has a reputation of being, you know, the home of Australian surf life-saving. And there was a terrible event one Sunday in the tail end of our summer, so around March, when masses of people from Sydney flocked to Bondi Beach, and that, you know, that led to the powers that be in New South Wales really calling that out as very bad behaviour and, you know, bad things. So our sporting codes were changed as well. Our football, we were going into the football season, and other sports, those seasons were interrupted, and then eventually after about 4 weeks, I think they came in, but players had to lock down in particular states where there was not a lot of COVID. So, you know, it's been a time of unprecedented measures, but certainly a lot of things on the domestic in domestic life, let alone in hospital. So I know at the time from visiting family or attending healthcare facilities that there were absolute bans. There were no visitors allowed in our hospitals in Queensland, so only the patient was there. And I think that must have been so hard for any patients, you know, to not have the support of their family around them when they were unwell. And yeah, crazy times, crazy times.
Absolutely. But the Bondi Beach example you described highlights how the general public has really struggled with these lifestyle changes. Do you think that, broad brush speaking, that most Australians were more accepting of these elements, or did you see a lot of pushback and challenges and people not adhering to the recommendations?
Again, you know, I really can talk of my own personal experience. So I saw something happen here that I'd never experienced. And it might not seem so foreign to you and our colleagues in North America, but two consecutive Sunday evenings, actually, I was watching free-to-air television, and all of a sudden, in the middle of the shows that I was watching, we had sudden news flash, and our Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, appeared in the lounge room of my home, and Mr. Morrison had a message for us about what we need to do as Australians, and, you know, based on the National Health Department advice that our politicians had and leadership had made decisions to do particular things, so close down gymnasiums, close down non-essential services, and that was across the country. So, you know, I actually was confronted by that. I just said to friends, you know, how dare my television watching be interrupted by, you know, a politician. I was quite cynical about it. And I would have been that way irrespective of which party the politician came from. However, I just, you know, to me, I went, oh, you know, it's like FDR's fireside chats. We just don't do that here in Australia. And ridiculously, Mr. Morrison made a comment about the Australians and their toilet paper scavenging. And he said, you know, just don't do it. And so the next day, I'm going to confess, I went straight out and bought some toilet paper because I could. So, and, you know, I didn't need it. So I'm quite kind of, it made no sense to me. But I think that what happened is, even as rational as I like to think I am in terms of infection control and prevention, you just couldn't but get caught up in this wave of, you know, it's almost like this swarm of people reacting for this virus and really putting their own self-determination and their own self-protection as a priority. And, you know, I was particularly amused by friends of mine, close friends that I've known for years, telling me what to do to protect myself from this virus. You know, and those people that told that to me, you know, they came from financial backgrounds or teaching backgrounds, none of them from healthcare, but I just found that fascinating. And I smile because I think, you know, we may see, hopefully we may see one benefit come out of this epidemic, this pandemic rather, and that could be just whole generations younger than me who understand the importance of basic basic infection control measures and human behaviours. So for all, you know, everything that you and I have done for 20 years or more, in my case 30, Mark, the messages that we tried to hammer home and people so often didn't want to hear what we had to say, you know, finally we've been given, I think, some validity and credibility. However, I do know that my IP colleagues here in Australia working at the front line are frustrated because they're seeing healthcare workers, non-infection prevention and control healthcare workers, really oppose them in some of their recommendations. So, you know, these are very strange times. So I hope that gives you some insight as well into another way that we responded. And I will go back to your original part of the question, which was, how did people respond? I mean, you know, I was immediately defiant, but then I learnt to comply. Whereas what we've seen, particularly in Victoria, where they've had very harsh lockdown measures following their substantial and horrible second wave, which thankfully they're now coming out of, what we've seen there is just an increasing intolerance of Victorians to remain in locked down or even semi-lockdown states. And I think that they've just been worn down. So we're starting to see things that are unusual for Australian cities. So we've seen, you know, protests lately and protests against the police. So, you know, there's a lot of resistance. And we've seen people trying to sneak in over the borders. And just in Victoria, we saw people not wearing masks, you know, blatantly not wearing masks and refusing to do that, even though there were penalties for doing that, for not wearing a mask in Victoria, and, you know, potential for court action within the court systems and having a record. So I think, you know, human behavior has been interesting, hasn't it?
It has. It's like we're all in this grand involuntary sociology experiment, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It really is.
Well, let's switch gears here. So the U.S. healthcare industry has been rocked by supply shortages and distribution challenges during the pandemic, both for personal protective equipment and disinfectant supplies. How has Australia fared this year?
Yeah, it's been really difficult for us. So a couple of issues. We realise, I mean, I've known for a long time, but I think many other Australian healthcare workers realise that we relied very heavily on importing our major PPE materials. So that was problematic because many of them were imported either through China or through North America. And I think you and I have discussed it sometimes in the past, Mark, how small the Australian market is in terms of healthcare. And I think my understanding has always been that we're less than 1% of the global market for healthcare. So, you know, really doesn't matter. It doesn't really matter if a company can't supply us. And that's frustrating because, as you also well know, our healthcare workers aspire to have the safest healthcare system, or one of the safest healthcare systems in the world, where we know that quality care has been given. So states were given access to the national stockpile of PPE, which is managed by the federal government. But I talked about people not being familiar with fit testing. So what they realised is that, you know, people weren't familiar with fit testing, but very few organisations were willing to sacrifice their masks for education and training purposes because they actually believed that they should quarantine them for when they're needed for possible face-to-face contact. So in some of the hospitals, I think that they had to really work out how they could distribute and use limited supplies of PPE, particularly face masks. And then we saw another interesting thing happen. We saw the importing by some of this, or the purchase by some of the states and territory governments, who felt that their own state stockpiles perhaps were limited and knew that the national stockpile of PPE and associated materials was limited. They started to import materials, you know, from other countries closer to us. And one of the problems that they had was that the manufacturer of those materials was not as it should be. And we then had healthcare workers complaining because they were only given low quality PPE. So that's been something that's been very difficult to manage. And I hope when our health leaders have an opportunity to, you know, stop running and managing in crisis mode, they will look very seriously at our management of PPE nationally. We saw a fascinating thing happen with hand hygiene solutions. So we have in my state, and in many others, I suspect, many microbreweries that have been distilling things like gin. So, you know, we have some gin distillers, and many of them adapted overnight and began to use the alcohol to develop hand hygiene solution. So, you know, that it really brought into focus the importance of having a regulatory body like your FDA. We have the Therapeutic Goods Administration, or the TGA, and they had to change their role to give, you know, temporary approvals, or to highlight temporary approvals for PPE and materials that were safe to use, but also they had to develop a system whereby they could block the importation of PPE that was not up to standard. So, you know, I think ethically at the clinical workplace or the front line, people must have asked themselves, you know, is it better to have, for example, no mask, or, you know, is it better to have a mask that's low quality in the event that I don't have a high quality mask to wear? And, you know, that's probably highlighted for our profession, you know, great ethical considerations that we need to think about. And then, you know, a similar difficulties came up around the reuse of masks, and the reuse of single use masks. And I'm talking, you know, the either surgical masks or P2 masks or N95 masks. So, you know, they were situations that we hadn't thought very deeply about in Australia, and, you know, it almost was so oppositional to what we'd put out as primary messages and key messages over the years. So, again, I think it'll be interesting to see how that changes medical industry as well.
That sounds very familiar to what we were experiencing here in the U.S. You know, with faulty PPE, healthcare workers and staff must have been incredulous, and rightly so, you know, being on the front lines and not being able to afford them the protection that they need and they deserve.
Yeah.
So switching gears a little bit here, again, the entire Southern Hemisphere all seem to have an exceedingly low flu season during this year's winter, which of course corresponds with the Northern Hemisphere's summer as described in the recent MMWR article. Does that surprise you, or do you think that we're going to have the same thing here?
Well, I certainly hope you do have the same thing there. And, you know, I couldn't imagine that you wouldn't, if you're experiencing similar COVID strategies and outcomes in the US. So what we saw was just a dramatic reduction in cases. So between the period of June to August, I've looked at Australia's data, and for the same period in 2019, Australia had about 165,000 confirmed cases of influenza. So, you know, let us not realise that perhaps some people who did have influenza weren't tested in 2019, and perhaps similarly they didn't test in 2020. But from 165 almost cases in 2019, in our entire winter, which is June to August of 2020, the same period this year, we had 536 confirmed laboratory cases of influenza. So we noted, or, you know, our influenza experts noted that reduction was first happening in March 2020, and it has continued through to October of this year. That's the latest I can see the data. So, you know, why do I think that happened? I think it happened to just increased infection prevention measures across the country and across the community that we'd not seen. So this, you know, increased alcohol-based hand gels and hand hygiene formulations everywhere we went, you know, from gas stations to supermarkets to outdoor parks and things like that. We had those restrictions that you and I have spoken about, so families not going out and mixing with other family members, or restrictions on the small gatherings. I think we had some fantastic community education material, so, That was a good thing done. Messages, daily updates of how the importance of just following those basic infection control measures. And we had the increased vigilance that went into workplaces, commercial workplaces, as well as healthcare settings. And, you know, we had fewer people within our hospital, so we didn't have those visitors. You know, we had that distance in community when we went out to shop. So I think, you know, that could be part of the issue. I'm not really clear on the exact reasons, but certainly that home-based lockdown, social distancing, mask wearing by people in the community, and the increased hand hygiene, I think that they had to have been part of the contributing factors. The other thing that we did have, I can't recall if I spoke about it earlier, is that our healthcare workers from March onwards were encouraged to have influenza vaccination. And around that time, we started to see real issues with COVID in our aged care facilities. And in fact, I think that there was a mandate from a national level for the first time that all healthcare workers working in the aged care sector must have influenza vaccination, other than if they had, you know, a reasonable reason not to have that. So, you know, I haven't been able to find statistics that paint the picture for me of how our national influenza vaccine rates were over the equivalent periods of both years. But I do suspect there would have been an increased use of vaccination I know definitely there was in the aged care, and I suspect probably in hospitals, many Australians just believe that they had to be flu vaccinated because it would give them a degree of protection against COVID-19. That doesn't make sense for us thinking about how vaccinations work and are specific for diseases. But I think that everyone was so fearful they did whatever it took. And I will look forward to seeing that data come out on influenza uptake. So I hope that, you know, my colleagues and our colleagues in the Northern Hemisphere are continuing to be, you know, so vigilant in offering influenza vaccination to healthcare workers, obviously people in the aged care setting, and I would hope across the North American public communities as well. I think it's a really, you know, it's such an important public health measure.
Yeah, hand hygiene, social distancing, staying at home, getting your seasonal flu vaccine. That all sounds kind of familiar, doesn't it?
Well, you know, and I will say, as I do every year, I'll be looking at North American activity, particularly because it's often been the predictor for us for the oncoming winter season that we have as you head into your summer of 2021. So I'm sure that, you know, we will learn as much from your Northern Hemisphere flu experience this year as you hopefully have from ours.
Thank you. So I had this last question, but I think we've already addressed it. What advice can you offer IPs in other parts of the world faced with forthcoming challenges of COVID-19 and influenza when COVID rates are dramatically higher than seen in Australia?
I would just say, you know, continue to promote that uptake of vaccination. And I know that IPs everywhere are fatigued. I imagine, you know, and they would normally be fatigued at this time of the year anyway, to have lived and managed and worked through a pandemic of this size and magnitude. I know that they're very frustrated. They're weary. It must have been just a hellish year for them. So, you know, I like everybody, I would just offer to IPs around the world, you know, as always, know that we share your pain. We need to stand united, definitely, on what's happening, and that each of us, I know, can encourage other IPs around the world. That's certainly been my case for my entire career. I've been encouraged and mentored so well and supported so well, particularly by my North American colleagues. So I hope that, now as we come into the summer, that people listening to this podcast can be a little bit hopeful. I think, in the next 5 to 10 years, we will see a dramatic rise in the recognition for IPs, and it may not take that long, and might come immediately after COVID settles down, if it ever does. But IPs do a great job. They're an essential part of any healthcare setting, and I know that, if I consume healthcare in Australia, as I know would happen as a consumer of healthcare in North America, we're only safe, and we're only getting the high quality infection risk reduced care because of the work of IP. So please keep it up, and just help us spread the good news, give some hope, and fight that good fight as we always have.
Yeah, we stand stronger together, don't we?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Dr. Murphy, I cannot thank you enough for joining me today and providing us some insight into Australia's experience, both with SARS-CoV-2 as well as influenza. I think our listeners have really learned from your experience as we get ready to enter our own flu season while you get to start enjoying a summer, which I hope will include some fun. Thank you for today, as well as your contributions of your lifetime of service to infection prevention and control.
Thank you, Mark. As always, it's been a pleasure to speak with you, and to have this opportunity to share the message. So you take care, and try and find some time to celebrate over these upcoming holidays. Thank you so much.
This has been a PDI podcast. Thank you for listening, and I wish you health as you continue to be the difference.